It's The Wonky Show. It's all about the election again this week as we talk about what's being said in the campaign and what might come next as a new government takes power. It's all coming up.
I'd like to see a policy mandate that tells employers and businesses and they have to provide a certain number of placements, internships, graduate schemes, mentoring schemes, a whole range of opportunities for universities, for students to get real world experience as part of their degree.
Welcome to The Wonky Show, your weekly way into this week's higher education news, policy and analysis. I'm Wonky's editor-in-chief, Mark Leach, and joining me on the higher education policy doorstep this week are three fantastic guests as always. On the University of Leeds campus, it's Pam McPherson-Barrett, Head of Policy and Regulation at the University of Leeds. Pam, your highlight of the week, please.
Hi, Mark. Well, we've just got back from half term, haven't we? And we went away with family, had a really great time. All the cousins play together, even though they're almost grown up now.
Lovely. On City Island, don't know where that is, Chris Shelley, Director of Student Experience at Queen Mary University of London. Chris, your highlight of the week, please.
Well, I don't want to sound boring, but having just come out of half term, I was also on holiday last week, so it would be remiss of me to say that I wasn't enjoying chasing my children around a holiday park in Spain more than returning to work.
And in North London, it's Debbie McVitie, Wonky's editor. Debbie, your highlight of the week, please.
Well, tomorrow it's my son Sammy's 6th birthday, so apart from the evening that we are going to be spending wrapping up lots of presents, which is going to be a little bit tedious, we're really looking forward to his party at the weekend and general kind of hijinks.
No, we start the week with lots of stuff about the future post-election. Debbie, what's going on?
Well, this morning, former Vice-Chancellor of Sheffield Hallam, Chris Husbands, has published a pamphlet for HEPI in which he explores four different futures for higher education in England. So he's got four different scenarios about what that kind of medium-term picture might look like. The first is essentially about nothing changes. There's no policy change, no new funding. And he paints this picture of essentially decline. Some institutions would kind of struggle on or be all right. But a lot would merge. Some would disappear entirely. Participation falls. You'd lose subject diversity. All the kind of things that make the sector impactful would become kind of less. We'd see less of that. The second scenario is I think probably what the sector would most like to see, which is about it, what Husbands calls fully funding the 2010 vision. So basically, kind of pegging fees to inflation and boosting fees to kind of make up for the erosion over the last decade. Increasing research funding, really doubling down in international recruitment, and of course the sector would thrive, but nothing would really change. And I suppose whether you think that's a kind of palatable kind of version of the sector depends on whether you think that everything in the sector is sort of perfect. Chris also, I think, thinks that that's probably quite politically unlikely, and perhaps we'll talk about that a little bit more. His third scenario is the kind of classic tertiary model, where there's lots of local and regional focus. Innovation funding would perhaps be fed into that local landscape as well, and there might be kind of compacts around international students in regions, and about how those things could all fit together. And I think this is a version that quite a lot of people sort of expect is where we might be headed. But the fourth scenario, I think, is one that people find a bit scary, but I think it's worth talking about. And I think this is sort of, Chris does quite a good job of sort of saying this is, we need to think about this, what that might look like. And that's about differentiation. And it essentially depends on fewer universities being research intensive and having access to quality related research funding. Those institutions that currently do a lot of the heavy lifting on widening participation, on regional engagement and delivering on that broader kind of skills agenda, really, really double down on doing that well. And you have really quite different student experiences. And of course, you've got specialist institutions kind of doing specialist things as well. This is sort of Chris's, sort of provocation to the sector to think quite carefully about what the political realities are and what sort of version of the future we collectively might like to see.
Pam, there's lots of different potential futures here. Which door are you opening?
I can't imagine that we will be in what Chris calls a benign funding environment. I think that anything that the government have on offer over the next few months and years is going to be a quid pro quo. We will have to change something. I would like to see something around scenario three, but I just don't think the funding is there. So I'm going to go for a differentiated system. I think we'll have to evolve to survive as a sector.
I mean, I think the first thing for me is that it's just nice to actually be having these conversations. And I think it's finally hard to imagine that that any government, whichever it might be from July the 5th onwards, will be able to ignore the question about the future of higher education in the way that it's been ignored for the last few years. My personal view, I'm a slightly risk averse person, is the second scenario that Chris highlights here around let's continue what we're doing, but can we just make sure we're funded properly, please, is the one that I would probably be most drawn to personally. But I think these are four really interesting options that are set out, and it's absolutely the right time to be asking questions around what could different look like. It will be interesting to see how much the new government want to really tackle higher education, or whether they just want to tweak around the edges and try and keep us quiet, because it is a big question that simply has to be answered in the next term.
I think for me, there's a real question about the pressures of the short term versus the aspirations of the kind of medium to long term. So I think, and Mark, obviously you've written on the site about this morning, which is that we know that the Labour Party and possibly the future party of government is very well apprised that the sector in its current state is really facing quite a lot of financial difficulties, that there's a decent risk that some universities will get into kind of serious financial trouble to the extent that they may be at risk of insolvency. And this has been identified as kind of one of the six things that might, that is sort of going to be on the desk of the incoming government, and probably rather far sooner than they would like to. They won't have a lot of time to look around them and think, right, what are we going to do? So there's a kind of, a basket of questions about what you do in the short term to stabilise the sector, whether there are consequences around some of those actions that you might take about, constraining yourself in the long term. But then also what that longer term vision might be, because if you can buy yourself time doing something like a modest fee increase, it wouldn't fix everything. It certainly doesn't match up with Chris's scenario too, where he's talking about kind of increasing funding across the piece. You can then perhaps put the sector in a stable enough position to be able to engage in that longer term thinking and structural change that you might wish to do, but would perhaps be dependent on better economic circumstances, more availability of funding to support that transition, and also sort of securing consensus about what that future looks like. I think the reason that Chris put this piece out there is because I don't think there is really, there's a sort of sense that maybe we'll drift in a more tertiary direction. And I think other scenarios are available. I'm not sure that Chris has kind of covered all the possible bases, but certainly I don't think, while we're still in this kind of position of having to shore up and avoid catastrophe, lots of universities are making decisions not based on thinking about the future and what that kind of optimizing the sector. They can't, they've got to focus on optimizing their own kind of performance right now. That's always the sort of the tension that's going on here.
The piece this morning I argued that the government, just in a very basic level, just needs a kind of a new government in July needs to introduce a kind of get to safety package, and signal that more money is coming, and do a bunch, and it can do a bunch of stuff that doesn't cost an enormous amount of money. We know they're not happy with the system as it is. We know they're not happy with the graduate repayment system, or certainly where the dials have landed. We know they're not happy with levels of student support and maintenance, and so we can expect from that, I think, that there will be some action there. Meanwhile, as you say, Debbie, there's obviously recognition that universities collapsing is extremely problematic and high up on the risk register, as on Sue Gray's on the famous shit list, as it's now being called. But I'm just interested to take everyone's views about this, because I put this out this morning, and lots of people are writing in with various different views. So whether you think the sector could accept this for kind of get to safety package for 18 months, 2 years ahead of a bigger review. Maybe Chris Husbands will come back and do the big review. But Pam, do you think on a kind of tactical level the sector could swallow a bit of maybe some tougher access on WP, maybe some other elements of quid pro quo for say £500 or £600 extra per student?
I think they probably would. I think we'd want to see a more benign immigration policy landscape.
Absolutely.
As well.
Yeah. Yeah. Absolutely.
I think there's definitely something around widening access that we could speak to. My other thought is that we would need to be demonstrating that we're supporting economic regeneration, because most of Labour's plans are predicated on reviving the economy. So there is something there around, are we, you know, how do we make sure our graduates are in the right places and able to contribute effectively? And that's not just about income, it's more broadly in that enterprise and thinking differently innovation landscape. But the other thing I wanted to note is we're not really talking about PGT or research students when we're having these conversations, and their funding environments also increasingly constrained. So when we start having the wider consultations and the conversations, I do think we'll need to start remembering that we've got more than just undergraduate students at universities.
Yes, true, absolutely. I think, you know, Chris, that's a really good point, isn't it? I think, you know, a lot of this game is going to be about the economy and how universities contribute to growth, which is the primary agenda, isn't it? Is that, you know, how do we kind of square that with, you know, the other bits of the mission? Because clearly there's going to have to be a reframing around a lot of that sort of stuff, isn't there?
Yeah, absolutely. I think the key thing for us is that we need to be, you know, front and center in those conversations around the future of the economy, and be a key part of leading and driving the economy rather than a kind of a secondary factor. So, you know, if we're really truly to consider different options of funding the sector of you know, how we are a part of economic growth, we can't just be you know, an afterthought. Something like, you know, degree apprenticeships are created, and actually, you know, it almost felt like we were the kind of silent partner in that. There's some funding created, there's a levy on employers, we'll send these degree apprentices into universities, but actually we won't necessarily ensure that universities are, you know, have got the resources to then, you know, fully deliver and support these apprenticeships, and £2.7 billion of the apprenticeship levy goes back to the Treasury and spent because we weren't necessarily a front and centre part of driving this new initiative. Lifelong learning entitlements, again, feels like something on the horizon, which is an idea that's been created to almost do to us rather than with us or to help us lead. So I think, you know, whichever of these options may or may not be explored, and whatever other conversations happen with the new government, you would like to think that higher education, it can be a part of the discussion and the solution rather than just a tool to be used.
I think that's such a good point. Because I think one of the kind of weird tensions that we have around talking about higher education policy is we do sort of keep returning to this assumption that universities or higher education more broadly, or even higher and further education and the whole kind of post-compulsory sector, is the thing that's the kind of the objective policy, if that makes sense. But of course, if you look at Labour's missions, you know, the objective there is to say, how can we orient all the different bits of government, you know, and really focus everyone on really thinking about economic growth and delivering that kind of, and you know, equitable economic growth as well, you know, with you know, taking that regional lens. And, you know, to do that, as you say, Chris, yes, you've got to get absolutely everybody around the table to co-design. But, you know, as Andy Westwood said at our Wonky Live briefing event we had earlier this week, he sort of said, you know, the problem here is that we have this kind of low growth, low productivity economy. And I mean, and I've written about this for the site in the past, is that part of the kind of problem is that our economy's absorptive capacity for graduate skills is, that's part of the problem. And I think one of the things that we've seen over the past decade from the current government is a sort of blaming universities for the outcomes of their courses, when actually this is about the whole ecosystem and really a sort of ducking the harder questions about economic, you know, about what sort of economy that we have the capacity to build as a country, and what, you know, and how to kind of best utilize the enormous skills and capabilities of young people and returners to education, and kind of deploy those in a way that builds capacity and creates productivity. And like, obviously those are incredibly tough questions, and it's not like we can just be like, oh, if we only shift the lens, it's all going to change. But I think the idea that universities have somehow failed to deliver on this stuff and therefore sort of shouldn't be in the conversation, and we should be pushing people away from university and stuff like that, I mean, that is, it's such a dead end road, isn't it? And it would be so great to be able to see universities at the table really contributing to this conversation. But it will take universities to also say, look, this isn't, we need to be kind of, I guess, sort of sort of sector blind in thinking about this. You know, we as a sector have to orient ourselves around this bigger mission, which is about economic growth and about, you know, improving the quality of life for everybody.
You can find my piece and links to Chris Husband's happy piece in the show notes on wonky.com. Now, let's see who's been blogging for us this week.
Hi, I'm Paul Martin, and this week on Wonky, I've been blogging about the targeting of widening participation outreach programs. In my blog, I share the findings of some academic research I've carried out, where I evaluate the effectiveness of the Realizing Opportunities outreach program, which aims to support more disadvantaged young people to attend selective, research-intensive universities. My statistical modeling reveals that a big part of the success of the Realizing Opportunities program is the fact that most participants do not appear to be likely to attend research-intensive universities prior to their involvement in the programme. But I also express some concern that for too many other WP outreach programmes, a large number of the recruited participants already seem likely to reach a specified goal even before their involvement in the programme. This means that all too often, we could just be preaching to the converted.
Right. Now, it's election season, as we know, so we're getting a glut of manifestos. Chris, tell us what's going on.
Yep, that's right. We're obviously seeing the manifestos of the major parties. Well, every party who's standing a candidate coming out. But also, every sector, every body, every industry also at this time publishes their own manifesto for the changes that they would like to see from an incoming government, and higher education is certainly no different. So we've had a swathe of manifestos coming from sector bodies and various partners to the sector this week coming out and making requests of the future government. A couple of interesting ones to highlight. Sutton Trust, as you can imagine, have made a whole range of requests and recommendations across the whole education spectrum, starting with early years. But from a higher education point of view, they're talking about contextual admissions being more extensively used by selective universities, increasing maintenance support to a level that reflects students' actual costs. And from a degree apprenticeship point of view, 50% of the employer's levy being ring-fenced for under 25s, and a care leaver bursary for young apprentices being extended to young people eligible for free school meals. The Royal College of Nursing have asked for a commitment to government-funded nursing degrees with a job guarantee for graduates, and also helpfully pointed the punitive immigration policies has been a significant barrier for internationally educated nursing staff. The Lifelong Education Institute have suggested that universities are mandated to create a department of lifelong learning in collaboration with local education providers. We've also seen manifestos coming out from Wellcome, from the British Academy, and various others. So, yeah, an interesting week to see new ideas floating around.
Lots of interesting stuff in here. Debbie, you liked the British Academy one, didn't you?
Well, I mean, I like the social sciences, humanities, and arts. And, you know, and I think the British Academy does a very good job of representing them. I think part of the what I think is important to kind of clarify here is this is very much about organizations setting out their kind of special interests, isn't it? And what you hope happens is not that these kind of then materialize in party manifestos, which are sort of, you know, long been kind of signed off or whatever, but that they all go into the kind of big sausage machine of government and perhaps kind of materialize as policy ideas for the future. So you see things like in both Wellcome and British Academy will talk about, you know, instead of saying we need a stable research funding environment, this will allow research and science to flourish. It will also create a bit more space for some of these social sciences, humanities, and arts subjects that are essentially under quite a lot of threat from the current financial pressures facing the sector. I think my broader point, I think, was particularly, and I make this in the British Academy, but I think it probably applies to all of the sort of special interest manifestos, is that you can't assume, like, because you know, if you think about a government coming in with kind of enormous, you know, people sort of say this government is going to have the big, you know, the most complicated, difficult in tray perhaps of any government since 1945. So you cannot expect that just because you deserve to be given, you know, attention and funding and legislative time, or that you have made a kind of, you know, significant case for the value of what you do, that even if you really, really deserve it and it's a really, really jolly good idea, might still not happen because it's just, you know, there's a limited basket of funding, there's a limited amount of policy attention that can be given. So you've sort of got to do the hard yards in thinking about what is the alignment between what I'm proposing and what that kind of, you know, what that sort of likely bigger picture is, and how, you know, how might this contribute to the government's agenda. So it's great that the Sutton Trust is saying, well, let's talk about social mobility. It's great that the British Academy is talking about social sciences, humanities and arts. Welcome's talking about science. You know, they're all doing kind of cracking jobs at talking about the stuff that they know about. But there's, I think, also a job to do to kind of begin to stitch together some of these things and sort of say, well, how do these things actually interact? What might it look like if we can't get everything we want? And that's, you know, that's not a manifesto thing. You know, that's not, you don't put that out in your kind of glossy PDF, but you know, you sort of hope that those conversations are going on behind the scenes, even as these kind of lovely documents are being published.
There's lots of interesting stuff in there. There's no point in us going through each one probably. So I'm going to ask each of you what would you put in your personal HE manifesto if it's Pam McPherson Barrett, you know, PDF with your, you know, face on it, your vision for higher education in the next Parliament. What are your policy for the top five policy asks, Pam? I'm coming to all of you.
I really liked the lifelong learning as a policy principle, and I think that we could actually deliver something really quite powerful. I would, you know, speaking as somebody who works at university with a lifelong learning centre, the work that they do with adult learners and bringing people into education and giving them life skills, I think is vitally important. It can be transformative. So I would put the policies and the funding in place to actually allow that to expand rather than shrinking year on year, which is what it's doing at the moment. The skills piece, we talked about it a little bit in the last item as well, but that, you know, bringing people to the skills levels that are needed, but then also ensuring that employers are able to receive that and act and capitalise on the graduates of all ages and disciplines to help bring the economy forward. So I think they would be my really top two. And then that research piece, because if we want to be a science superpower, if we want to pivot into, you know, the next few years as we tackle global warming, climate change, and the advancing technologies that AI are bringing, we need to make sure that our universities are places where that sort of research can, you know, can take place and can be capitalised on. We're not just importing from other countries.
Excellent. I love this platform. This is brilliant. What about you, Chris?
I'd like to see a stronger policy relationship between business and higher education, really, in terms of supporting graduates into employment and graduate skills. There's an awful lot of great work that goes on between universities and employers in various ways, but it has to be quite hand to mouth. You know, we go out and reach out and build partnerships, and sometimes it's very much one way. I'd like to see a policy mandate that tells employers and businesses and industry that they have to provide a certain number of placements, internships, graduate schemes, mentoring schemes, a whole range of opportunities for universities, for students to get real world experience as part of their degree.
Mm. Nice. What about you, Debbie? What's in your personal manifesto?
Well, I've got the kind of luxury of going last, and also the I think if we sort of willy conceptual thinking is very much my stock in trade, so I don't think this is making it into anyone's manifesto. But I think for me, it's kind of, I'm thinking as Pam and Chris have been talking about knowledge and about, I guess, sort of perhaps recentering the idea of knowledge as being this kind of really kind of socially valuable thing. And I don't mean in the sense of kind of we've all accumulated lots of factoids and we're all kind of in the pub kind of telling each other about, you know, titration or something. It's more just that kind of, it's sort of bringing together that sort of sense of, you know, sort of we've had enough of experts, and sort of moving on from that world and sort of saying, no, knowledge is powerful, knowledge can connect us, it can enable us to do really interesting things, and we can be kind of creative if we know about things, and we can kind of understand what we don't know, and it sparks curiosity, it enables us to kind of move forward as a country and be sort of dynamic and do interesting stuff. And I think, you know, the idea of the knowledge economy it feels very kind of 20 years ago. So I think I would probably, if I were to think about it, and I think under this you get lots of kind of stuff about innovation and research and creativity in the classroom and all that sort of stuff. You know, a manifesto for the knowledge economy of the future or something like that would probably be my take. But I think I need to work that up a bit, more.
I was going to say it's not exactly doorstep ready, is it?
But no, it's not. No. I don't think I've got any votes with that.
I like what you're thinking. But we'll put the links to the all those manifestos in the show notes on wonky.com. Now, Mickey Mouse has made a return to the HE policy debate. Hooray! Pam, walk us through it.
Oh, I'm very fond of Mickey Mouse, who Google tells me is one of the highest value fictional characters in the world. So I'm not sure we should be having less Mickey Mouse. However, this is one of the two recent Conservative policy announcements aimed at rather than for young people, I would suggest. Essentially, what they're doing is they're going to say, we'll identify the low quality degrees, we'll get rid of those, 13% is going to go, and we are going to then put all that funding into 100,000 apprenticeships. There's some great articles on Wonky. David's done some of his analysis and his tables, and the maths doesn't quite add up on this one. The idea that we're going to be able to move those students between doing apprenticeships and higher quality degrees or getting a job, I think is it's quite an optimistic interpretation of this policy announcement.
Yeah. Chris, it's so somewhere between kind of boring and irritating, isn't it? This whole thing. Where are you putting it on the scale?
Oh, definitely both. DK's blog this week is brilliant at highlighting the flaws in the plan. And what he starts by pointing out is that this has been floated last year, the year before, the year before, the year before that, the year before that, and the year before that. So it certainly is boring. And it's frustrating because, you know, yet again, we come back to this, you know, this silly phrases around, you know, Mickey Mouse degrees and rip-off degrees and low-quality degrees. And, you know, how these things are measured and defined is never quite clear. It seems to be a bit more based on the subjective view of the government or the Prime Minister of the time. And it's really frustrating because, you know, on the one hand, the government have published a creative industry sector vision, which acknowledges and accepts the true positive impact that creative subjects, for example, make to the economy. I think, you know, the UK creative industries generate over £100 billion a year, and the sector is growing at 1.5 times the rate of the wider economy. So the creative industries are something that we should be celebrating. And yet, when the Prime Minister starts talking about, you know, Mickey Mouse degrees and low quality and focusing direction towards the arts and the humanities, actually, he's undermining one of our success stories. I don't understand the logic of publicly, you know, slating and criticising and undermining what should be one of our success stories. Higher education overall is a massive success story for this country. And when we talk about, when we hear the Prime Minister talking about, you know, rip-off and Mickey Mouse and low quality, it's undermining that completely and giving an unfair impression. And it's hugely frustrating for everyone who's inside the sector and you know, concerning for the views that might generate among the wider public or the global public. The only thing you can hope is that they also recognise that it's been something that gets said every single year without any necessarily real substance and follow through, and that they equally ignore it as boring. But it's certainly frustrating.
Well, we have been debunking this now for about a decade on the site.
Shows our impact, doesn't it?
Yeah. And you know, aren't we clever? Aren't we clever? You know, and you know, on the pages of Wonky, we've rubbished this time and time and again. And yes, they've not done anything, and it's all been hot air. But obviously, we always have to do that job, don't we, Debbie, of kind of turning the page and saying, where is the kernel of the truth, of the nuggets of the thing that they're trying to get at?
And, you know, pointing out that lag data isn't actually a valid measure of quality, as it happens, doesn't really answer the challenge, which is that a lot of people, and you know, and yes, there's a kind of segment of voters that the Conservatives are sort of targeting here, which is those who don't have degrees and who are sort of sceptical of the value of spending what is objectively quite a lot of money on studying for 3 years something that doesn't seem to be kind of directly relevant to, you know, in, you know, heavy scare quotes, the real world. You know, there is a school of thought that says this is, we just don't understand this, and we are kind of quite open to the kind of idea that this is all a big waste of time and a big waste of money, and we sort of like the idea of apprenticeships because we know what that means. And you know, that exists, and that is a real thing. And I think, but also on the site, Jim has taken a really kind of sensible approach to this, which is saying that, you know, yes, data that tells us that 3 years ago or 5 years ago, graduates of a particular course didn't earn so much, it is completely useless in understanding what is happening now to students who might be experiencing the sort of quality that they could legitimately less than the sort of quality that they could legitimately expect. And, you know, part of the problem is we don't have some of that. But, you know, we've talked a lot on the site about franchise arrangements. And of course, not all franchise arrangements are problematic, but there are providers which are kind of making enormous margins on the same student fee that, you know, large multi-faculty universities are struggling to kind of make ends meet with. So we have to kind of ask what is going on there. And of course, the regulator is genuinely asking those questions. And hopefully that, you know, those questions will continue to be asked after the election. So, you know, the question here is what do we think low quality looks like from a student perspective? And are there students who have made decisions without good quality information or have genuinely been given bad advice about where they should put that significant investment? And this is not, you know, and I think, sort of, you know, and the problem is because what the kind of the under-nuancing of the policy means that basically lots and lots of courses that are incredibly important and do incredibly important work in the kind of broader skills and education landscape get lumped in with a very small number of suspect courses that we can't really see, but we sort of know are there and probably would warrant a bit more attention. And it's about kind of finessing that and trying to kind of understand how we might get better sight of those phenomena.
I've got a year 12 child and a nephew. One wants to go to university and one wants to do apprenticeships. And with the best will in the world, it's not that easy for schools to guide and advise students. You've got young people who don't really know what they want to do for the most part. Apprenticeships are a thing now. People want to do them, but they're not set up in the way that university is. So you don't all apply in September and then you find out when you get whether or not you've got the place that you want in the new year. They're kind of, you know, they're coming up in a really ad hoc basis. Employers will, where their apprenticeships do exist, employers have advertised them when they want the apprentice to start, not when students are finishing courses. So even if we accept that there is a kernel of truth that there needs to be some more apprentices, we're not in a place where that the delivery of that and the putting the right students into the right apprenticeships is structured well.
No, and that's what my other frustration with this is. We always seem to somehow find ourselves in a position where apprenticeships are stood up against higher education, against a certain set of the courses that we provide, as if they're, you know, binary opposites, as if we're enemies of each other. You know, apprenticeships are a thing, degree apprenticeships are a thing, delivered by universities, degrees are a thing, and that choice for young people needs to be clear. That, as Pam says, I'm not surprised at all that that schools and young students are confused about what their options are, because it's presented in this way, low quality degrees are rubbish, we'll simply cull 13% and then invest more into apprenticeships. It implies that there's a kind of one good and one bad option on the table, so we'll remove the bad, and it's all part of a huge ecosystem. And it's frustrating when they're pitched against each other. And actually, our president and principal Colin Bailey this week has put a blog on LinkedIn where he extols the virtues of apprenticeships. He was an apprentice himself, but also, you know, calls out the comments from the Prime Minister around rip-off degrees. And all, you know, all he says at the end is, you know, can the next government just, you know, talk about this sector with pride and help us, you know, articulate and navigate this range of options and help young people navigate this range of options, irrespective of their backgrounds. But you know, give them a positive environment to enter.
Exactly. I mean, do some real thinking about, okay, what are the barriers to taking up apprenticeships? What are the contexts in which people are making these choices? How do we then support that so that people feel like they're making a meaningful choice? And I mean, likewise, I was up at the University of Leicester last week, which is a complete fantastic institution, and I was visiting the Space Park, and I was chatting to the guy who sort of set it up, and he's through huge kind of knowledge exchange. Is, you know, there's research expertise, there's a knowledge exchange agenda around kind of embedding industry, and they've got Rolls Royce there, they've got a bunch of kind of amazing businesses. They're doing lots of translational research. They've got postgraduates doing kind of knowledge transfer research stuff. And I sort of said in passing, oh well, like, I guess, you know, because you're so focused on working with industry kind of through the kind of traditional degree thing, I guess maybe you're not that interested in degree apprenticeships. He was like, that could not be further from the truth. We absolutely want to. We are building up all of our degree apprenticeship provision. We've got loads and loads of different things that we need in this, you know, around this whole sector, around the whole world, space world that is that should be apprenticeship led. There's so much kind of technical skills required, and so many opportunities for degree apprenticeships, and it all just works together. This is not about if we can make degrees a bit more industry led, then we don't need apprenticeships. You need both. That's how you create fantastic opportunities for lots of different sorts of people.
So that's about it for this week. To dig deeper into anything we've discussed, you'll find links in the show notes on wonky.com. Don't forget, you can get the latest show automatically. Just search for The Wonky Show wherever you get your podcasts. And to stay ahead of everything going on in UKHE, make sure you subscribe to our briefing and intelligence services. Details are on the site. So thanks very much to Debbie, Pam and Chris, and Michael Salmon, who makes the show happen behind the scenes. We'll be back next week. Jim will be here. Until then, stay wonky.